Okay, I'm going to first just tell you a little bit about how I got involved with trauma, a little bit of my story, so you know something about that. And then I want to give you some specifics, statistics about the trauma of sexual abuse among males, so you have some idea of what you're probably looking at here that nobody wants to talk about.
And Diane, can you speak up? I don't think that mic's that just recorded.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just recorded. It's
not,
yeah.
So, okay,
all right. And then I'm going to tell you some lessons learned as a caregiver, which is what you are, in the work that I've done. I'm a bit of a dinosaur. I entered the field of psychology in the early 1970s, and there were no books. There was nothing on trauma at the time. The diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder did not even come into existence until 1980. So I was starting out in 73 and meeting with Vietnam vets. And I was also one of the rare females in the field at the time. And so women would ask to see me in the practice where I was working because I was female, not because I knew anything, since I was about 24. And what I began to realize in interacting with the vets and the women was that they had the same symptoms. And then I began to hear stories from the women about violence that they had lived with and the specifics of that, which I'll say a little bit more about in a minute. But what I discovered was the vets looked like this. They had these things happening. The women looked like this, and they had these things happening. And I realized they both came from war zones. One was in another country, and one was often in the home. And so that was my introduction to trauma. At the age of 24, a young woman came to see me, sat down in my office, and literally said, "My father used to do weird things to me." I had no idea what she was talking about. And I went to a supervisor, and she started to tell me a little bit, and I told him what I was hearing, and he told me that women sometimes tell these stories and that I should not get hooked by them. I will contribute to their pathology if I believe them. So after hearing stories from a few more women, I listened to the women and quit speaking to the supervisor about it, which tells you a little bit about my personality, I think. And I began searching for things that would help me understand both the vets and the women. And I ended up reading the literature that had come out of from the survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. That's how I learned about trauma. Because when I would read their biographies, autobiographies, their memoirs, whatever, they sounded like my vets and they sounded like the women I was seeing. And so they are really the ones who taught me about violence, the abuse of power, trauma, oppression, and the destruction of human lives. I sat with women who had suffered chronic, horrific abuse from fathers, uncles, grandfathers, teachers. I worked with a university co-ed for a while, helped her with a depression. She didn't show up for her appointment, and I found out she had been murdered. I worked with an adolescent girl who told me she was being abused by her father. And again, nobody called the cops in those days. There was no mandated reporting. There wasn't anything. But I called the cops because I was ticked off at what was happening to my client. And I interacted with a great cop. He said, "Invite the father to your next meeting. I'll be there." So I did. And again, you know, I'm like 24 years old, and I'm expecting this huge guy to come in the room who's really scary. He was really small. He was very quiet, and he had on his bedroom slippers. So it taught me something about perpetrators. What they do is big, but often they feel very little. And the cops were there, and they took him out of my office in handcuffs. So needless to say, these events were profoundly shaping. And I look back now and realize that God was teaching me about desperate humans and unspeakable atrocities, things that I had never encountered in my own protected life, and didn't even know existed until I started listening to some stories. So he spent a lot of years teaching me about what it means to be human and what suffering does to humanity and some of the things that people need in order to heal from atrocity. And then somewhere along the way, he added a second track, which was not one I ever looked for either, to my experience as a clinician, and he started bringing me pastors. So I've worked for 45 years with trauma victims and probably close to 40 with pastors. And many of them at the beginning came because they were burned out, crawling on all fours practically because they'd been chewed up by churches or by very difficult things on the mission field, or many of them had experienced trauma themselves in other countries. And so I was tending to victims and to shepherds, and sometimes I was tending shepherds who were victims of trauma as well. And then one day God allowed my two worlds to collide, and I began tending to shepherds who were predators. And so those have been the three things that I have done over the last 4.5 decades. I began encountering not only pastors who fed off sheep, but I encountered churches who closed their eyes and their ranks to protect the abuser rather than the victim. So shepherds and churches became predators, institutions and Christian organizations were protected, and I learned about what we call systemic abuse. I sat with a Christian leader who beat his wife up black and blue, and he told me I was still young, and I didn't really understand that sometimes force was necessary to accomplish God's will in the home. I called a pastor about a woman in his church whose life was very much in danger because her husband was battering her. He sent her home because that's where women belong. I worked with a young girl who was sexually abused by her youth pastor. They helped him move to another church in another state and called me and said, "Diane, we would not want to destroy such a dynamic ministry, would we?" So at some point, I began to realize that working with things human can destroy a caregiver. And you probably don't need me to tell you that. You work with toxins. I work with toxins. We work with poison when we work with broken humanity. And of course, we carry the same poison in ourselves. And I reached a place in my professional life where I was ready to quit. I didn't want to do it anymore. I didn't want to hear any more stories from anybody, let alone shepherds who were herding sheep. But God used all of that to teach me a great deal about himself, about his heart for victims, about his heart for poisoned humanity, and about his heart for humans who also poison others. I have learned some remarkable lessons which I want to share with you today. But I know now, as a result of all of those tracks, he has taught me something, and I'm sure it's very small, but something about his heart for suffering humanity, whether they are victims, shepherds, or shepherds who make victims. So in the context of these experiences, I want to give you some of those lessons and hope that I can encourage you as caregivers in a warped and twisted world. Before I give you those, I want to give you some statistics which are true about the population that you work with here. Someone is sexually assaulted in the United States every minute and a half. Childhood sexual abuse occurs in the lives of 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men before the age of 18. Now, those are the statistics we have. There are many factors that favor non-disclosure, so they're not really true. It's a lot more than that. The average age for sexual abuse to begin is age 6 for girls and age 10 for boys. The majority of abusers are male. 3 to 7% are female, Please note that that means there are female abusers. And I think there is recently, I would say in the last 5 to 7 years, been more in the news about women teachers, women coaches, whatever, who have abused young boys in their care. And I suspect that the percentage of female offenders is much higher than we know, because I also suspect that if you are a 14-year-old boy and you are being sexually abused by your teacher, you probably brag about it as a trophy, do not look at it as abuse. But it is. And it has damaging effects, of course. Most abusers are considerably older, but there is also a change. There is a troubling increase in the United States in younger perpetrators. Law enforcement officials say that in recent years, 33% of those arrested for sex crimes were younger than 18. Male rape occurs all over the world. Boys are raped by the bigger and stronger. Boys are trafficked here and around the world. Military sexual assault, rape in prisons, rape during war, all have male victims. There was an article in the American Medical Association Journal that said boys born in poverty and raised in homes without a father are at a much greater risk for rape. By age 12, these are boys in poverty and raised without a father, by age 12, the rate of using alcohol, cocaine, marijuana, and IV drugs was 25 to 50 times higher if those boys were sexually abused. Abused boys have 12 times the normal suicide rate, and they go on to have a much higher rate of mental illness. Recent research regarding men who are in and out of homeless shelters multiple times, do the revolving door thing, suggests a 40% rate of child abuse of some kind. There are other studies that go as high as 70%. Research shows that male prisoners have been assaulted prior to prison at staggering rates. Prisons, there was one study done with prisons up and down the East Coast in the last few years and found something like a 90% rate of sexual abuse prior to prison for inmates. Prisons, homeless shelters, and rehab centers show elevated numbers of those with a history of childhood abuse. The silence surrounding the abuse of males has left an untold number of men to suffer in silence. One out of every 10 rape victims is male. And males 18 to 24 and in college, so that's a more privileged group, are 5 times more likely to be raped than those in the general population. 44% of the victims are under 18, and 93% know their attackers. So that doesn't count all kinds of other violence, and like domestic violence witnessed or experienced growing up, or all kinds of things that happen on city streets and everything else. That's just sexual assault. And so a part of what I want you to hear, and I'm going to give these stats to the men this afternoon, part of what I want you to hear is that trauma underlies the lives of probably close to 100% of the men that you work with. And it's my belief that things like addictions are used as anesthesia to numb trauma. And we have not figured this out. We've been very slow in figuring this out. And so we treat what's really a symptom. The addiction is the symptom of the trauma. So we've been treating the symptoms, which we need to do. But if we don't get to the wound, and that's what the word trauma means, is wound. If we don't get to the wound underneath, it just keeps making stuff. And that's why they cycle back around. So here's some of my lessons. Number one, counseling or caregiving is not nice. You know, when we're young and we start out, we think it's nice. It's about caring and compassion and perseverance and wisdom and all those nice things. And it's true, it is about those things, and those are nice things. But caregiving also has to do, as you know, with indescribable suffering, impenetrable darkness, inconceivable deception, cruelty, brutality, and evil. To enter the suffering of any kind is to literally invite garbage into your life. People come to us during what I call alarm moments, where everything is like this. You know, it's like the alarm going off in the house. You know, there's noise and chaos and pain, and they want it stopped. They're afraid. They want somebody to fix it. And so people bring us their fear and their anger and their sobbing and their panic and their grief. Oswald Chambers, who's a very favorite author of mine, talks about having staying power in the alarm moments of others' lives. That's what you're doing. Your work is to have staying power in the alarm moments of these men's lives. So you face suffering, but you also face deep, habituated sin. You sit with those who've been raped, whether you know it or not, those who've been battered, those who are grieving, those who are addicted, those who are diseased. If you do caregiving, you hear things that you didn't think were possible that humans do to one another. And no matter how articulate you are, you will hear suffering you cannot put into words. You will face sin. Some of it we're familiar with, but some of it is so habituated and so old and has been around not just for decades in one life, but in generations in a family, that sometimes it feels like that's all the person is in front of you, is that habituated sin. Secondly, if you do caregiving, you will be exposed. You know, we think of caring for others who are suffering and they're exposed in front of us with what's going on in their lives. Well, the work of this caregiving thing will expose you as well. You know, we go into this thinking that we're kind. People usually have said that about people who want to be caregivers. You're compassionate. You're a good listener. We see ourselves as patient, perhaps, intuitive. But whether or not those things are true will be exposed when you work with something that is relentless in front of you. And you'll meet somebody somewhere, or probably lots of somebody somewheres, who will take you to the limits of any good quality that you have. Your patience, your compassion, whatever it is that's there, you'll find somebody who will run to the very end of the road on that, and you're done. You can't sit with unrelenting addiction or abuse without coming to the end of your patience or your hope or even your rationality. You can't sit with lives destroyed by things like drugs and violence without getting angry. And I'm sure you are aware, when you're a helper, what people are doing, they're lining up to bring you the worst of themselves. And we all know from our personal relationships that the worst of someone else tends to bring out the worst of the other person. I mean, that's one of the things I think we discover in marriage. And if you don't know for sure if that's true, then I would suggest you pay attention to yourself when you're stuck in traffic. When you're exposed, what we need to remember is that the person sitting in front of us is not the enemy. They're not someone we need to manage so we can stop feeling exposed. What I've come to learn is the exposure of me to myself, and unfortunately sometimes to my clients, is orchestrated by the Spirit of God, because I have 15 therapists who work in the office with me. And one of the things I say frequently is, when somebody brings us somebody to help, he's working both sides. And so when you work with people who take you to the limit of yourself, God is there. And whether they're going to listen to him or not, he's called you to listen to him and the work he wants to do in you through that broken life. Three, we have to learn, and this is an interesting point given what you do, but we have to learn how to sit with pain in other people without immediately injecting a narcotic in the person we're helping or in ourselves. Now, we don't typically do that with drugs when we're a caregiver. We do it with words. And as Christians, we often do it with Scripture's words. We say something to immediately make everybody in the room including ourselves, feel better, which there's nothing wrong with using scripture, obviously, but if it's being used by us to try and lift the pain away so we don't have to look at it anymore because we're uncomfortable, we have used it wrongly. Because part of what scripture actually does is bring light and expose. It does not deny pain or its source. We have to be careful about pain because it is the only way that the human constitution says something is wrong. It's one of the terrible things about leprosy. People don't feel pain. Now, that sounds like a nice thing, but that's how you lose arms and toes and all kinds of things, because you don't feel pain. Pain raises its voice against things that are wrong, whether it's with the body or the heart or the mind. If you jump to silence pain in somebody you're working with, you'll never find the wound underneath. And if you don't find the wound underneath, it'll keep festering and leaking out into the life. I think pain is the Martin Luther of the human framework. It plasters the walls of the city with the announcement that something is not right. When pain exists physically, we call it disease. When pain exists emotionally, we call it suffering. And the absence of emotional pain in people is numbness, deadness, which is what addiction does. It's also the incapacity to feel joy. You can't do away with one side of an emotional continuum without also doing away with the whole thing. When pain exists in the moral realm, we call it conscience. If you don't have pain in the moral realm, you're probably a sociopath. The absence of pain with disease, with a disease, like a physical disease, if somebody doesn't have any pain or symptoms and then they die and they open them up and they say, oh my gosh, they're full of this disease, they call that a silent killer. Pain would have helped them. So yes, you work to alleviate suffering, and you should, but you also need to learn how to listen to pain and study it and understand it and follow it till you get to its source. For when you do this work, it's actually not your work. You're doing God's work with him. Caring for broken people is not our work. It's his. We can't fix anybody. But he has called us and given us the privilege of sharing in that part of his work. If you're gifted to bear burdens, he has gifted you to bear burdens. It's his work. We think it's our work, and we ask God to help us with our work. But it's actually God's work, and he's asked us to come alongside with him and let him teach us how to do his work like he does. We have it backwards. The people that you work with here are not yours. They're his. And many times, I think if we're honest, those of us who go into some kind of caregiving role in life somewhere, at least when we were young, there's some little thin messianic strain floating around in there. Because what? We think we can help. Really? We really think we can help broken humanity. We think we can help sin and suffering. We can't even manage our own. There is only one Redeemer, and I am not he. I am his servant. And he said, my food is to be obedient to the one who sent me to accomplish his work. Five, you're doing God's work for him. You're not doing it for you, and you're not even doing it for them. We're not working for the people or for ourselves. It's easy to think that it's for the sufferers. You know, I'm doing this for them, for their suffering, for their burdens, whatever. But you see, if it's done for them, you're going to end up governed by them, because what if it fails? What if they're not pleased? What if they're really, really angry with you? Success is not what happens in them. Because you see, some pain cannot be gotten rid of in this life. Some people have the wrong goals. Some people you work with, and I'm sure you know this, will not be pleased with what you do, no matter what you do. So if you work for them, you will be in bondage to their responses, to their accomplishments or their failures. It's also very easy to do this kind of work for ourselves. You know, it can feed us. It feeds our egos, or we feel wise or important or whatever we want to be. And sometimes I find in my field, certainly, and I would think in all caregiving fields, that there are people who run into the pain of others to avoid their own. And when that happens, of course, then that work can easily lead us to feed off the sheep, to use them to make ourselves feel better in some fashion. Number six, you can only do God's work through him as he does his work in you. And again, that's the both sides of the equation thing. You can't do the work of the Redeemer here at Helping Up unless the Redeemer has done the work of the Redeemer in you. So let the work expose you to yourself. And then when it does, run to the cross. Caregiving's hard. The work of God is hard. The work of God in the lives of those who are brokenhearted and shattered beyond recognition and captive in bondage and afflicted. We prefer happy, healthy, whole people. And we want to be one too. So we must bow to the work of his redemption in us, because it's only as he makes us like himself that we will actually be fit to do the work that we do or that you're doing here. I've had to learn over the years to bow down and seek him to do his work in me so his work through me might be accomplished. When you think about that, one of the things addicts need is truth. I mean, they are really good at deception, right? You really think you're going to be able to bring truth into lives when you won't let the truth of God work in yours? Seven, the stuff of caregiving is contagious. This is like Ebola here. You need to be protected. You know, you and I are image bearers. We've been that from the beginning. In the beginning, the image bearer bore the image of the Creator. We don't do that so well now. That's all messed up, right? What happens is we still have the capacity to bear an image. The men you work with here are bearing the image of the people that they have known in their lives. They look like what they've lived through. So do we. So if you sit here absorbing, absorbing, absorbing for years, if you aren't careful, you'll catch what they have. They deceive, you'll learn to deceive. First yourself a little bit, maybe, and all kinds of things. It's a contagious thing. I always tell therapists, trauma is contagious. You know, you hear about secondary trauma all the time, or vicarious traumatization. That's what that means, that you've caught the disease. I remember years ago, I was in an airport on the way to a conference with two colleagues. I think it was Atlanta, I think. It was people everywhere. And we were walking down an aisle or something. And there was a man in front of us, and he was holding the hand of a little girl. And it was one of those, she was about four, and she had blonde hair. And you know how sometimes little girls walk and their hair goes like this? She was darling. And one of my colleagues said, "Oh, look at that precious little girl." And the first thing in my head was, "I wonder if he's abusing her." And I went, "Whoa, that's not okay, Diane." That's contagious stuff right there. That's what it is. It's very easy to catch. You can't sit with disease and depression and fear and abuse and addictions and everything else and not be shaped by it. You are working with hazardous material. It's the nature of human beings to be affected by what they sit with. So if you're not careful, you're going to bear the image of trauma, bear the image of addictions in yourself. I mean, this is even true of Jesus, yes. He bears the image of our sin and trauma in himself, still here, right? So that's what happens to humans. And so, number eight, we must be a perennial student of people, yes, but of God himself. We need to be relentless in seeking the mind and heart of God. Obviously, you need to understand people, which is a fascinating thing. We'll never get to the bottom of it. You need to understand suffering. And in understanding things about suffering human beings, you need to never assume that you actually understand. Listening is key. We start to think when we work in a particular area after some years, I get this. No, you don't. Because every single person is an individual. So if we don't understand that, we'll make wrong judgments. We'll jump to conclusions or whatever. But if you're going to avoid bearing their image in wrong, destructive ways to your own life, you need to seek God and know him. You need to know his word. If you're going to serve as his representative in this place, you better know him really well. Otherwise, you'll misrepresent him. And you need to deliberately, in your personal life, seek antidotes to the work that you do. Some years ago, I came to the end of my rope, and I pretty much told God I was quitting. And I sat down one day, and I wrote a list of all the characteristics of my work. You know, it's ugly, it's dark, it's chaotic. It was a long list. And I held up the list, and I said, see this? That's why I'm quitting. And he pretty much said to me, I want you to write another list. I want you to write the opposites. So I did. Light, beauty, order, whatever. And I realized when I finished, this side is who he is. This side is what I work with. And not only do I need to seek him in terms of his word and all of those things, but I, because I'm a human creature, need to seek these antidotes in concrete ways. So I need beauty in my life, and I love the woods. I love birds. I need order. When the world feels chaotic, I listen to Bach. I need light, not just spiritually, though that's absolutely foundational, but I need it in human ways. And if we don't continue to seek those antidotes, we will get twisted up by the work that we do and start to look more like the work than we do like the master. 9, there's a great gift in the work of dealing with suffering people, and the gift is the work of the cross. In Isaiah 45, it says this, thus says the Lord, I will go before you and make the rough places smooth. I will shatter the doors of bronze, and I will cut through the iron bars. I will give you the treasures of darkness, the hidden wealth of secret places, so you will know that it is I, the Lord your God, who calls you by your name. You walk in rough places, and I'm sure you bang up against a lot of bronze doors and iron bars in the people you serve here. It'll stamp out any idealism you came in with if you do it long enough. It will bring you to the end of yourself. It can make you cynical. It can lead to despair. But if you look, you will see a cross high and lifted up in that darkness. And the one who is there bore everything you will meet in this place. There is no story of abuse and violence. There is no story of corruption and deception. There is no story of addiction and rage and battering. No story about racism and suicides, and anything else you encounter. All of those things that make us want to run, he bore in that place. And in that same place, he carries my fear, my rage, perpetrators when I hear what they do to children, my stupidity, my arrogance, my struggles. All of those things, if we let them, the things we work with and the things that come from us, are there in that place. Caregiving for hurting human beings is not a nice place. If anybody didn't tell you, I'm telling you now, it's an invitation into darkness. But in the darkness, you will find him crucified. And you will find hope in despair and resurrection in death. And if you find him there, you will be transformed. And that transformation in you will affect those that you work with and that you work here to serve. He says the treasures of darkness are there. We don't think about darkness as having treasures. But what he says is the treasure is himself. I will show you the treasures of darkness so that you will know who I am. That's where it will take you if you let it. And then lastly, we must ever and always do this work in utter dependence on the Spirit of God. In other words, we need to wear humility well. I mean, do we really think that we have what it takes to work with complex, deceptive humans, to understand them? We rarely understand ourselves. Where are we going to find wisdom for the complicated lives you deal with here? How are you going to know when to speak and when to shut up? And how are you going to love when you're weary and somebody just isn't showing any sign of hope? You can't walk the long road of healing and transformation with other human beings apart from the work of the Spirit, and you can't bear and release the life and work of Christ crucified apart from the Spirit of God. The work that you do here confronts lies, darkness, evil, bondage. None of those things do you have the power to change. And sometimes I'm sure you sit with a life and it is unspeakable, the suffering that has gone on. I think of times when I've sat with people, a woman trafficked by her own parents from the age of 5 until 25. There are no words for those experiences. I've been to Rwanda many times, and sat across from men and women whose heads are carved by machetes, and listened to their stories. And you sit with similar darkness here. Apart from the work and word of God in my life, I have nothing to offer. You and I cannot, doesn't matter how many degrees we have, how smart we are, and how much we want to help, we cannot fight the litter of hell in human lives apart from dependence on the Spirit of God. And if the suffering weren't overwhelming enough, the years and layers of deception and lies and sin found in the life of someone who is addicted, who or he's been a sex offender since the age of 12. I mean, you can't bring life to dead places like that apart from the Spirit of God. For me, the practice of caregiving requires a servant of God who's steeped in the Word of God, who loves and obeys God in public and in private. And then that person is sitting across from a suffering sinner who is vulnerable now because of the damage in their lives. And bringing all of the wisdom and truth and knowledge and love available to us through Christ, remaining dependent on the Spirit of God minute by minute as we work with these people. And that work, no matter what you call it, counseling or psychology or caregiving or ministry or whatever else, that work will be used by God to change us into his likeness, and that work will result in his redemptive work in those that we sit with. And that work will, in some measure, bring glory to his name and lead us hopefully to that day when we will hear him say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Thank you. Do we take questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
I have a question.
Sure.
Considering the statistics that you gave about differences between men and women and trauma, do you have any insight or things that you've learned about the differences in treating men and women who have been experienced with trauma? And If you hadn't heard, Hope Out Mission is considering, or will be, opening up a women's program. Mm-hmm. And do you have any tips or guidance as we formulate the approach to that?
In many ways, I have not found a difference in the way I work with men and women who've been abused, let's say, except that men are much more reticent to speak of it. And I have found many men who will tell me their story of sexual abuse when they wouldn't tell another man, because there's a certain sense of degradation to their masculinity that they somehow can, I was going to say face more easily. It's never easy. I don't really mean that word, but I don't know what else to say. But they can somehow face it. So sometimes men who come to the practice who have histories of abuse will ask to see a female therapist because somehow it feels less threatening to them. So I don't, you know, I'm sure there's men that's not true for, but that's been something that I have seen a lot of. And abuse like that, of course, and I'm going to talk to the men this afternoon about shame, which is present, of course, in both female and male victims. But it is often different in men because a part of it is culture and tradition and stereotype, maleness and all kinds of things. Somehow, if you were abused as a 10-year-old boy, you should have been able to stop it because you're a male. You're not supposed to be weak. And so there's an identity thing that happens there in terms of their gender, I think, that you need to be aware of. In terms of the women's home, I mean, I'm delighted to hear that. My goodness. It's
going.
Yes. Maybe you could lead something in the country, because that's not a very common thing to happen. It will be complicated. It will be complicated because some of them will have children. And it will be complicated because some of them will have enraged males who will want to come and kill them. And so you're going to have to think the safety thing through really, really well. Because they come out of domestic violence, they come, you know, they'll have pimps, they'll have all kinds of things. And you will be in the way. And then you have to deal with the thing with children, because so many of them, of course, have children, and then they don't know how to parent at all. And the children may not be safe with them, and you want to teach them how to be safe with their children. And there's all kinds of things that you don't actually have here because of those. So, and I'm happy to stay in dialogue about it, you know.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But, you know, I would say probably 90% of them will have a trauma history, if not 100.
Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh, yes.
You mentioned about shame.
And, yes.
You know, so you talk a little bit about shame. I mean, deep down, there's a shame. You know, you do something wrong, you get caught. There's a shame like that. But this is deeper. You know, trauma caused by, you know, shame caused by deep sexual abuse. It's a violation of the person.
Of the self. Yes.
The self.
So, yes.
So what drives the shame? That they allow themselves to be violated?
Well, that's one level, but actually at the bottom, shame is not something bad happened to me, but shame is I am bad. It's part of what trauma does is change identity. So if I do something bad to you, I feel guilty, and I might feel some shame if I'm caught, because nobody ever wants to be seen when they're guilty, but what you get with the deep shame that comes, particularly with sexual abuse and other kinds of trauma as well, but I am a defective human and there is no redemption for that. So it happened to me because of my defect. So it goes all the way down to the toes. Yes?
So is that shame, is it coming from more embarrassment than anything else?
Well, there certainly is that, because, you know, people don't want to be seen as somebody who was abused or used or violated or whatever. But embarrassment is like the thin layer at the top. Because I get embarrassed, but I still know who I am. It doesn't change my identity. what's happened to them is that they, you think about a child, a little, I have a grandson, you know, or and two granddaughters, whatever, you watch them growing up through different stages, and they're learning to trust or not trust. They're learning safety or not safety with their parents. They're learning then how to go out a little bit with friends, and they're testing those skills and everything else. If you've been sexually abused, say, from the age of 3 or 4, that alters. You don't trust. You never trust anybody. You don't, and it just goes on and on.
I'm guessing what I'm saying, a better word would be humiliation, not embarrassment. Let me put it that way.
Yes, that is absolutely humiliating. It's and degrading. It makes you feel less than human. Right. Yes?
A couple things. I'm thinking about one part of the guilt and shame thing, which has been put to me by people I've looked at. Guilt. Is I made a mistake. Shame is I am a mistake.
I am the mistake. That's yes, fine. That's exactly right.
And I spent a long time out there in the drug world. Until I came into here and I really stopped fighting the idea that okay, God is real and you know, everything else, it was all just wasted time. When I came in here and I found a place and said, okay, I'm going to stop fighting you, God. Go with you. Let's see what you got. I don't know. I came to feel that those all those years out there were not wasted years. There were experiences I couldn't have gotten any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made a lot of difference.
Yes. Yes.
I don't feel like, okay, I just blew a half a century of life for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 50 years out there learning all these different things. So now I can relate pretty much to anybody, whatever the situation is. Coming back to something else you were talking about, I've been here 2.5 years, and I've had to deal with a lot of stuff, for a long time here. And you start to get to a point where it doesn't matter what I do or what I try to tell people, stuff's still going to happen. You know, things are still going to go. I would say this a lot different if I wasn't talking to a lady, of course.
You probably can't say anything I haven't heard before, just for the record. I started out with Vietnam vets. They increased my vocabulary.
You were talking about those feelings that come in, about coming, you know, it gets to you. And several of us went through a peer recovery specialist thing, training for 50 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was stressed the most in that thing, real good part, there were two things. One was ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing that really struck me was self-advocacy,
mm-hmm.
self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Because you really do start to, you know, like you say, if you're dealing with that all the time, it affects you.
It does, and it should.
There's
something the matter with you if it doesn't. I mean, you're a block of rock if it doesn't affect you, and that's not good.
I never got rid of my humanity. I still feel, and I'm not sorry to be released for that.
No, you don't want to lose that.
No, I keep hearing that same thing.
Yes.
You know? And I appreciate the fact that you said it like that, because it's really you have to keep pulling back.
You do.
Remembering that.
You do.
Yeah.
And you have to know the difference between their stuff and your stuff.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, their stuff isn't your stuff. You got your own stuff. But a part of what you're talking about in the first part is, part of what you're seeing as you look back is that this God that you've met can redeem anything.
That's true.
I mean, it doesn't matter all the broken pieces. Of course it matters. But, I mean, he can pick them up and make something out of them that brings him glory. Go figure.
Yeah, go figure.
And then in the work that you're doing, what he's done is say to you, look, you are a man created in my image, and I love you. Treat yourself that way. Treat them that way. But don't stop treating yourself. Don't lose yourself in their stuff and not treat yourself that way. Yes.
So this is very, so the work is really complicated. And,
yes.
And people like us who really care deeply try to figure things out. And so we read books. We listen to people like you. And we do a lot of that. At a certain point, you can get it. And I'm wondering if you have some simple steps that help caregivers say, okay, I've done my homework, but I still feel like I don't know too much. And it's pretty heavy. There's so much I continue to understand in this complicated world. Is there a way just to keep things simple, keep it a little bit light, so I don't get too... And I think this speaks to the contagious nature of,
yes, absolutely.
Of this work. But at a certain point, you say to yourself, okay, what do I need to do now? Lighten up. And can you speak to that?
Yes, and that's what I mean when I talk about the antidotes. And they're different for everybody. You know, if I play with my grandchildren for a little bit, the world goes away.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's like, it does lighten it. There's certain music that does that for me. The beauties of nature do that for me. You know, for other people, it's some solitude when nobody talks to you for a while, you know, or I can give you categories, but then we have to personalize it, and then we have to proactively, deliberately pursue those things so they're in our lives. Because if you wait till you run out of steam, it's going to take a long time to recover. And so you don't want to do that to yourself. It's much harder.
And one follow-up question. Uh-huh. Another complicated area in our world is when we go to foundations for funding, mm-hmm. the question comes up, well, what is your success rate? And
that's a great question when you're talking about human beings, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
Oh, my gosh. This is so complicated. And do you see people making progress?
Yes.
And we anecdotally know we're doing the right thing.
Yes, yes.
But scientifically, to prove to someone who is not even working this complicated world what our success rate is and how we measure success, is there any thoughts about how we should think?
Yes, yes. That's a very difficult place to be, and I don't have to deal with that because I'm not a nonprofit. So I have a phrase, another one of my phrases that I use with all my therapists, and that is that the work is done little by little. But when I'm talking to people, and it's not the same, but sort of, in other words, when I educate churches about things like this, like trauma, you know, they want to give them 3 verses and have them be all better in the morning. It doesn't work like that. You can't have a history of childhood sexual abuse and addictions and domestic violence and everything else and have 3 verses make you all better in the morning. Even if you love the verses, it's still not going to work. So I will often personalize it. In other words, sit there and think about something that you've struggled with in your personality or character since you were a kid. It could be fear, it could be anger, it could be whatever, criticism of others, whatever. How you doing? Are you all better? No, not if you're honest. Have you changed? Yes. Could I put you out there and say, here's an example of somebody who will never be angry again? No. I mean, inappropriately angry. Part of it is you want them to think about what it is to be human and how really supernatural it is to see anything redemptive happen in any human being. And that the transformation of a human being is work that is beyond what we can accomplish. But we can move it forward. We can whatever. People think, I'm fine, they're not fine. Make them fine, tell me how many you did that to. But they're not fine. And if you talk to their wives or their husbands, they would tell you. Yes.
Spoke a lot of physical trauma, whether it's sexual or physical abuse. I didn't hear anything about emotional trauma. So do you deal with that?
Oh, sure. Yes.
Way?
Verbal, emotional trauma. I mean,
we
work with a lot of...
Neglect or rejection.
Yes.
And which is, there's not a lot of actual conversation that went on or a lot of...
It's the lack of.
Right, lack of... Because as humans, we need interaction. You
absolutely.
Need companionship. And,
yes. Well, and yes. And I would say this also. My clinical experience with those who have suffered severe neglect is that that recovery is harder in many ways than those who have suffered abuse. Because you can look and say, that shouldn't have happened. But how do you look over here and say, that should have, when you don't even know what it is? They can't imagine, they don't have files. And an abuse survivor has a file for somebody stopping doing that. Now, they don't know what it's like to feel whole and all those things, I know. This person over here doesn't have a file because they never saw it. Years ago, I had a woman that I saw who had been abused, sexually abused, and I'd seen her for quite some time, and we were sort of dancing around the idea that God might actually love her, and she was a little hesitant about that idea and whatever. But she decided one day to go to a church. She couldn't picture a father loving. She didn't have a file for a father. She never saw a father love in her neighborhood, certainly not in her home. So she went to a church for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months, and she went every Sunday, and she went late and sat in the back pew, and then she left early, so she didn't talk to anybody for 9 months. And she would come back and tell me she went to church. She never really said much about it, and I just let it be. After about 9 months, she came in, and she said, I get it. What do you get? You've been talking to me about God as a father and that he loves me. In the pew in front of me every Sunday sits a man with his wife and two little girls. And I've watched him like a hawk and how he speaks to them. And I watch him, especially when the little girls are naughty. And I have never seen him treat his wife with disrespect. I have never seen him do this to one of the girls' arms. I've never seen anything except gentleness and respect and kindness. And that man, I think, is a taste of what you're trying to tell me God is for me. She had no file to picture something. And when you work with neglect, it's like a chasm. Nobody helped them. Nobody read them a story. Nobody assisted them in learning. They learned because somebody else was doing it, and so they tried it. There's no relational understanding of things when it's neglect. It's very, very difficult to heal from that.
And rejection is the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
I appreciate the work of the little by little and dealing with trauma. Some of the guys that we work with, you know, you have a session with them and they're gone before you get a second session with them. So if somebody were telling the story of their trauma, and you have to always think of it, this is the last time I may see
yes.
this
person. Yes.
Do you have a nugget? What do you say? That maybe give them some shred of hope.
Well, I probably would say two things. One is, whatever else you think of yourself, what you did today took a lot of courage. And I have respect for that. So if I don't see you again and you're back out there, you remember that somebody thought you were courageous. And you also remember that the person who thought you were courageous and heard what happened to you knows that that doesn't have to be the end of the story. You may not believe me, but I have hope for you. You remember my hope, even if you don't have any for yourself. Those things can be said to people, and 10 years later, they'll show up again and do the work. They stay. Nobody ever told them they were courageous. And nobody said that, you know. And I say to people, piggyback on my hope. You don't have to have hope for yourself. I've got enough for both of us. Yes.
So a few folks here are licensed therapists, but most of us are not trained in that way. But in a place like this, stuff comes out, right? People, guys open up about
whether you're trained or not, right?
Right. So any kind of just a few kind of general in the moment advice for anybody if a guy discloses, you know, starts to open up about particularly child sexual.
Well, partly what I just said.
Exactly.
You don't have to know what to do. And this is one of the things cross-cultural work has really taught me in ways that I didn't fully understand. The power of listening is just incredible. And we have a God who listens. I mean, so there's something like him in that. We think if we don't say something, we haven't done anything. Mm-hmm. You could be the first and only person who ever heard that part of his story. And so it's a privilege. He honored you. You tell him that. You tell him it took guts. You can't do that unless you got guts. Don't forget I said that. And I'm going to carry your story. I'm not going to forget it. If you want to talk about it some more, you want to talk about somebody else, we can make that happen. But whether you ever talk about it again, I'm going to carry it for you. And I'll remember your courage. What you're doing is saying things that show respect and honor and affirmation for what they did. I mean, they're going to put something out there and turn tail and run. I mean, that's typical. They do it in my office. Who wants to remember those things? And then who wants to look at the face of somebody you actually told them? They're not going to want to see you again because of the shame. What do you think? So you've got to put out there, these are my thoughts. So when your head tells you other things, you remember what I said to you.
Uh-huh. We have time for maybe one more.
I could ask one more.
Okay.
I know that this will depend on the situation and the person that's going on, but in general, I'm sure you've been asked a lot, why did God allow this to happen to me? And in general, what is your thought when asked that in general and maybe an answer that you... And I know you're not going to solve it, but what approach do you take to that question?
Well, the first thing is, I tell them I have no idea. Well, I don't know. I don't know why it happened to you and not to somebody else. I don't know why it happened to you this way and somebody else 10 times worse and somebody with none. You know, I can't answer those questions. So yeah. I'm really honest with that. I don't try to come up with an answer. There's no answer. It's a mystery to all of us.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty straightforward about that. But when somebody's really wrestling with it, here's part of what I do, and this is part of what I learned from reading Holocaust literature. Elie Wiesel was in Auschwitz, a very articulate man from whom I have learned a great deal, who died last year. But anyway, he doesn't say it this way, but he basically says, I can do God and know Auschwitz, and I can do Auschwitz and know God. That could make sense out of either one of those. How do I do God and Auschwitz? Well, I tell them that story, and that's what they're trying to say. I can do God and no sexual abuse. I can do sexual abuse and there's no God. But you want me to put together God and abuse? What the heck's the matter with you? So I pull that out. I want more from them about that. I want them to talk about it. I want them to talk about what that feels like. They have anger at God. They're afraid of him. They don't know if he's trustworthy, all those things. But eventually, the answer to that is the cross. It doesn't answer everything. It certainly doesn't say the why. But what it does say is that God and abuse came together at the cross. And I'm going to tell the men that this afternoon. And I'm going to tell them a story. Should I tell them the story? Are they going to be here, not there this afternoon?
Some of us won't be here. It's
a short story. A woman I worked with for many years, terrible history. She was abused by many people, lived in a rural area. But the thing that brought her the most shame was that a bunch of men every once in a while would drag her out to the barn, take all her clothes off, put her in the circle, make fun of her, and then gang rape her. That was her life. And she was a pastor's wife. And she couldn't put it together. And I really can't put it together either. So we did that. But one day I said to her, I want you to go home. And I want you to read John 19 something. And I didn't tell her what it said. I can't remember the verse. And I said, I want you to read it 3 times a day. And I just want you to sit there for a minute and say, what do you want me to see, God? That's all. So she came back. And she comes in my office door. And my couch is there. And my chair's there. So she's halfway across the room. I haven't even shut the door yet. She says, Diane, they took his clothes. They took his clothes. He knows. And that was the verse. Where it says they took his clothes. He knows shameful, humiliating nakedness in front of a jeering crowd. And that was this. So there's often something there, little by little, that you can take them to. And I don't, first of all, that comes later in the work. And second of all, I do it when they ask, not because I want them to know. And third of all, I try to get them to do the work. So I said to her, go read this verse 3 times a day and listen. I didn't read the verse for her. I didn't tell her what it said. I want the work to be hers, and then I want to see what happens. And inevitably, something like that happens, and that's the Elie Wiesel thing. She couldn't do gang rape and God. God did it. He met her there. It is the idea that even though I don't understand why you let this happen, you understand this thing. Mm-hmm. And you have carried it too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I've had that question. I've asked that question a million times myself throughout my life, and I have plenty of reason to.
I've asked it too.
I stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I started thinking of it this way when somebody asked me that. Who am I to question God?
Or explain him, for that matter.
God.
No.
I'm a human being. I cannot explain God to you or to anybody else or even to myself.
Right.
So I just accepted the fact that I don't know God's motives for what happened to me.
No.
And I don't have to.
But you do know what he did.
I do.
Which is what the, well, but I mean, in terms of this story that I just said, I don't know why he had that woman be gang raped for all those years. I can't even imagine any answer to that. But I do know that he met her in the place of greatest darkness in her life, on the cross. She was not there alone. Changed her. Doesn't explain him, but he shows up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so Dr. Langberg is going to take a little tour with us, and then she'll be talking with our guys at 2 o'clock. Of course, you're more than welcome.
We don't have class in here right now.
Nope. So if you guys wanted to hang for a little bit.
I think we're going to wait a few minutes before we take her on tour. If you want to just talk personally with her for a minute. Or
yep, that's good. Can you hang for a little bit? All right, thank you.
I know what this is. This is how this is good. It's going to be going with the maps.